Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Scott, how are you doing today?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. So I'm in Chicago. Listeners know that. Whereabouts are you tuning in from right now?
Yeah, we're headquartered out of Austin, Texas. I'm in my homes in southern Utah right now. It's the perfect season for mountain biking and hiking out in Zion National Park. So love to be here this time of year.
Sweet. Yeah, you got a great plant set up. I think some of the audience members have probably seen I did like a cameo on the printer for one of my episodes in the back of the bonsai when it was flowering for another guy, the wealthy gardener who came on. And it was a good book, right? It was kind of a rich dad, poor dad book, but maybe with a little more of like, here are the actionable items to get yourself a 40 or 50 unit residential portfolio that at the end of 15 or 20 years, you're sitting pretty with like 200 grand a year coming in, right? So it was a good episode. Maybe we'll link to that in the notes, but reminded me of that to see the incredible garden that you have going in the background there.
Yeah, man. I love having my plants around. I feel like they give me like a little bit of energy throughout the day.
Nice, nice. Scott, so for listeners, would you mind giving us maybe like the Reader's Digest version of the evolution of your business, real estate, and law career, and then sort of what the business model is today?
Yeah. So my company is Royal Legal Solutions, but I got started in real estate when I was in law school. I bought a commercial property and auto repair and transmission repair shop for the back taxes. And I ended up flipping the business in the building upon graduate from law school without any debt. And I thought I was going to be a hotshot litigation attorney. So I took a job, suing insurance companies and a law firm. Turns out insurance companies' business model is collecting premiums and denying coverage, especially when things get expensive. And then that's what attorneys do, is they sue them whenever they do that. So got firsthand experience about how does the whole game of insurance really work and how it's important for us to have insurance, but also to have additional protection in place. But the whole time while I was working as an attorney there, I continued to buy real estate, and I scaled my own real estate portfolio until I was making more money doing real estate than I was being an attorney. It took me about like a year and a half. I wasn't sleeping a whole lot at those times in my life. And I didn't need a lot of money, right? Because I wasn't married, didn't have kids. And I was like, hey man, I've hit it. I've hit my financial freedom. And I was like, I'm golden. But then I ran into the problem that I think a lot of people run into, which is like, wait, shouldn't I be structuring this inside of like LLCs? And should I be using trust to hold my assets and my companies anonymously? And what should I be doing with all of my taxes and my estate planning, and my insurance? And what do I want to be doing with like all that? And how's that all supposed to work? So I did what everybody does. And I was like, well, I'll try to read the books and I'll try to like contact professionals. And so I did all of that. And I realized that nobody really had a complete system like put together. And I had to put one together for my own. So I built my own team, of people, because I was like, well, I had the financial freedom, but I wanted the time freedom. And the only way I was going to get there is if I built a team. If I studied it for myself to understand how to do it for myself, and then built a team of people that do it for me on basically managing my wealth for me. And it was great. I finally had everything that I wanted. And I was traveling a ton and living a great life. And as I came, back and living inside of the States, a lot of my friends, real estate investors, and they asked me like, hey man, how are you doing? What is you doing? How are you living this lifestyle? Like, what is going on right now? And I was like, well, here's what I built and this is how it all works. And they're like, well, can I get in on that? Can you take on like more people and help me build this thing? So I was just kind of helping people out, getting them into the kinds of things that I had figured out for myself. And eventually, when I was like, hey, you should go on this Bigger Pockets podcast and go just share with people about asset protection. It's one part of some of the stuff, And I didn't think anything was going to come of it. So I like gave out my personal email and phone number into it. And what happened was I was getting, 30 to 40 phone calls a week, from investors all over the country that were like, hey, man, I really need help on asset protection and how all these other pieces are supposed to fit together. So then that's where I realized that, whatever you want to call it, that higher power in life was really tapping me on the shoulder. It says, hey, this isn't all about just hanging out on the beaches and having a good time. Like you need to be of service to other people, help them be able to walk the path that you've walked and get them to that place of being secure and having the true freedom and protection in place for keeping what they've worked so hard to be able to build. And that's Royal Legal Solutions is now turned into that. We serve all 50 states. We have over 2,000 clients that we've helped that are real estate investors. And we have about 30 people of attorneys, CPAs, paralegals, and support staff.
Cool. So before we dive into the asset protection, because that's probably going to comprise the bulk of our conversation, you know, asset protection, maybe the tax structures, I want to take a little bit of a detour if we could. So you're buying a property in law school. I don't know, you're 25, 28 years old, something like that. And you decide, I mean, did you decide, hey, I'm going to go out and find some kind of business to pay for this? Or was it like, walk me through, how did you find that deal, right? What was your thought process before you started to look for that deal? Maybe even how did you find or have the money? Maybe it was savings, but like, let's walk through that deal. Because that's kind of interesting. Not everyone's first deal is like, well, now I'm running this auto mechanic transmission shop and I got this commercial property. It's kind of unique.
Yeah, man. So I was a big saver. I've been working since I was like 7, mowing lawns. Like I've led my whole life. I've been an entrepreneur and always just saving money, right? So like I was the only kid that had like tens of thousands of dollars in a bank account that I would never touch because I'd be like, why would I spend it? You know, what am I going to spend it on? I don't really care about any of this stuff. So that kind of put me into a unique position, like financially, to be able to act on this type of opportunity. And I got to tell you that most of my life has actually not been hard work, right? In that sense of like having to scout for opportunity, right? Most of my life has actually been a place of me just really paying attention. And that as I pay attention, that opportunities just seem to pop up into it, like all the time. I don't know why, but all the time. I have so many opportunities that pop up for me, like all the time, of things that I can do. And that I think that really is probably happening for all of us. It's just probably for most of us that are out there, we're so caught up inside of our own heads of that we're actually just not paying attention to the world as that actually exists. Not to get too deep in the woo-woo, but I think that might be the case. So anyway, this actually just popped up because somebody actually told me about it. Like I overheard in a conversation. They're like, oh yeah, I saw a sign out of like this rundown like auto repair shop, you know? And I was like, whoa, that's awesome. Tell me about that. And they said, yeah, they're trying to like sell it. And he's like, I just talked to the owner that happened to be there, said that they're going to sell it for tax, so they'll sell it super cheap. So he was like, great. I was like, oh, let me talk to him. And I bought like the building and it was like an older guy and he wanted something to be done with it. And he was too old to do anything. So he was just like, yeah, man, I'll just sell it to you for the tax so I can just be out of having to mess with this. And that's where I got my first inclination of, I think what you actually understand, Daniel, is like people will actually be willing to make great deals if you can solve them with an emotional pain with it. And they will give you great financial terms if you can help them with an emotional pain of something they don't know how to resolve, right? I mean, that's wholesaling. The crux of wholesaling, I think, is built around that. And so that's how it happened.
So was he running the business at the time?
Yeah, like he had to have his doors were shut because he got injured or something, you know, and he was like, yeah, cool, I can't run it. And then, so I bought the building and then I found like another partner that actually knew how to run those types of like businesses, but like he didn't have any business sense, but he was a great mechanic. And so, and then I was able to do things like get us free publications inside of like the local newspapers by doing like newsjacking and other things that I had read books about how to do like promotion. So that's like, that was my role, right? Is like, watch the books on stuff. How do we get more publicity? How can we increase like our rates? And then his job was like running the actual shop and repair stuff on its own. And then we just took all the profits that we had. And instead of spending them, we worked to like fix up the building. So now at the end of it, because I was like, we're going to have a better asset. If we can make the business run and turn it into a profitable business, we'll get a multiplier off of the profitability. And then we'll get another kicker off of like having a hard asset that's going to appreciate because now we've, you know, pecked away at fixing it up over time. And like a beautiful building. This is not the Taj Mahal, right? I mean, this is like in the lower income area of like lower income areas, right? Of what's out there.
Where was that one located? What city? Just to get
it's in Albany, Utah. And if you look at if you look at the Albany Times, you'll actually be able to find one of the stories they wrote about us that we did about donating a transmission to a local charity and you know, like the fun story of like two law students like running a company and everything that we did there. So that was a fun time of life. A lot of work, not a lot of sleep.
Nice. I had Ben Reinberg on the show a few weeks ago, and a couple of listeners. The listeners probably remember this because it was recently. And we're focused almost like 95% on single family. We do a 10-unit building, 14-unit building, you know, small garage stuff, is 6,000 square foot type warehouse. And over the past year, we've kind of retargeted our model to include commercial property. So right now we're looking for like 95,000 square foot and up flex buildings that maybe need $1 million or $2 million worth in repair so that we can kind of like rebrand them as tech center, rent them out to other tenants. And Ben and I were talking, he's got like a $500 million portfolio. So I come into the show and I'm like, oh, I want to hear, you know, I want to hear like cap rates and like medical office, you know, best markets and all this. I want like this technical jargon. His advice was like, Dan, you just need to believe that you can do these larger deals. And that's pretty much all it boils down to. You just have to believe you can do it. It wasn't the answer I wanted, but maybe it was like the answer that we all need to hear at any given time. Cause it's like, you're in a position, maybe you had the money in the bank account, but you believed you could put the deal together. Otherwise, you never would have approached the owner in the first place in Albany, Utah, and had the conversation.
Yeah, that's true, right? But it's also true to the extent that like you can get caught in a trap where like you're trying to Jedi mind trick yourself into believing something that like you don't know is true. I think people that his advice is good advice. I would also offer to you another perspective, which is when it's the right time, it's obvious that it's the right time. There's not a question of when it's the right time. When there's real opportunity that exists and it's the right time for whatever you think coordinates this stuff in the universe into it, it's an obvious push to do something. And you'll sit there and be like, why am I being guided or feel like I need to go do that thing when I have no good reason to think that this will work? And that's what I say is like, this is where I'd say it's like, this is what I mean by paying attention. That opportunity is about paying attention. It's not getting caught up in all of these shoulds and trying to live all of the stories that you see on Instagram or other people's lives and how they did it. You really study what's going on with these people that are ultra successful and sit down with them like in long dinners. What you arrive is that they don't actually know what made them successful. They don't really know, right? Because if the story was of success was something you could know, then all of a sudden we would have used our logical minds to boil it down into a step-by-step process in which we'd be able to execute and everybody would be successful and the world would run perfectly like machines. But it doesn't work like that, does it? That means that there's actually something else going on. There's a mechanism at play that we don't actually fully understand. And I don't claim to understand it either. But what I do know is that the times in my life where I had the overwhelming impulse that like, hey, you're supposed to go do that inside of myself. When I followed it, it worked out really well. And when I had that feeling and I got scared and I didn't do it, stuff didn't work out so well. So now I kind of like, I think this is like one of those pieces, right? It's like, I just accept the fact that there's just going to be a million things I'm not going to go do. And there's a million lives I'm not supposed to go live. But really, if I just pay attention to what's actually true inside of me at any given moment, as I'm living my life, that the opportunities are going to be there and they're going to be obvious that I'm supposed to go do that. I don't have to wonder about whether I'm supposed to go do it or not.
I think I watched my belief level change over time. So when I first got in the business, I thought it would be a miracle if I could make $5,000 on the deal. In fact, 6 was the number. I was actually walking around telling people, here's how it works. You get a deal for 20 grand and you sell it for 26,000, you make 6,000. My first deal ended up being exactly a $6,000 check. And for a long time, my belief was okay with that. 6, 20, that was huge. You know, that was like life-changing money. 25 to fix and flip a house. And I remember actually having podcast episodes 4 or 5 years ago. And I remember people saying things like, we bought that one for 250 and we sold it for 350 and we made $100,000. Wow. That was like a 4-minute mile. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even believe it could be done. And what happened, Scott, is because I didn't believe, maybe I didn't believe I was worthy of the opportunity. Those opportunities were in my queue. They were in my CRM. They were already in my lead portal because I went back and looked for some of them and tracked what they ended up trading for and what I could have bought it for. And I had missed $100,000 deals, like multiple of $100,000 deals that had already, like, they were going to do business with us, but because we didn't really see the value there, we didn't believe it would work. We never pulled the trigger on it. And somebody else took the risk and somebody else kind of made the money, right? Yeah. And so that's kind of where I'm at with the universe. God will deliver the opportunity and give you the instruction, but you do have to match the belief to actually go out there and have the faith to take the action. I think that was kind of where I was going with that, because you're going to miss the opportunity, right? If your belief is different, you're not even going to have the right lens to see the deal. And it's hard, right? Because, like, to your point, I feel like there's things that I've tried to, like, believe for that was like my own idea, maybe not what the universe had written into the DNA of reality or fate at some level. And it didn't work out. So it's like, I could not take the action and it doesn't work out, but I could also take action on, like, my own fantastical inspiration or belief and it doesn't work out either. But when my belief is, like, congruent with
what
the universe has, that's when the real magic occurs.
That's 100%. We share the exact same viewpoint, right? What I'm advocating for is there's a perception, I think, that's out there that says I need to force my belief system to change. Yeah. And so what people I think are doing is that they're trying to do this, like, Jedi mind trick of forcing their belief system to change by, like, I'm just going to believe it and achieve it. You know, and I'm just going to, like, do this stuff or, like, and that's why people are like, look at people like doing that stuff. And they're like, I don't know, man, that sounds kind of crazy. You know, you're just going to, like, will that into existence. I was like, it never worked for me. Yeah. If it works for you or works for somebody else, like, you know, namaste, right? You figured out something that I haven't been able to figure out how to make work yet for me. What seems to be the case for me, right, is I think it aligns exactly with what you experience, which is actually when it's the right time. If I stay alert of what's going on in the world, right? I keep my eyes open, my ears open of what's happening in the world. The right information, the right opportunities will come into me. They automatically start to click and then I don't have to try. The belief system will actually just change. And I'm like, oh my God, I see everything differently now. This is came in, but it came in at the right time and the right place for you, for wherever you were at. And so what I'm advocating for is for everybody just to relax a little bit. Right. And just watch, keep your ears open, keep your eyes open, like, for that. Right. Just keep observing. Right. Stay relaxed and just observe. Right. What's happening. And then what will happen is the information that you need will come to you. Your belief systems, the structure, the team, and all of those things will actually just naturally occur. You don't need to force things into reality. The right reality for you will unfold in its right time. Yeah. Just stay relaxed, observe, keep listening.
All right, cool. Let's switch gears. We'll give the listeners what they came for.
Here. Yeah, yeah. We have a good old technical talk. You guys are going to get $10,000 in education here in the next 15 minutes.
That's right. So, asset protection. Let's say I am a real estate investor. I have somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, 2 in 10 houses right now. Maybe I've been at it a year or two, maybe 10 years. Maybe my net worth is 200 grand. Maybe it's a million. I don't know. How should I best structure these hard assets that are right now maybe owned with maybe LLCs or maybe personally with, like, my name on titles and my home address on tax mailing bills and things of that nature? How would the Royal Legal Solutions team structure my assets that I might not have them structured already?
Yeah, so I had a friend of mine who's a real estate investor, lost over $3 million from a single lawsuit. And he used to brag about his giant umbrella policy. And he's like, these LLCs and stuff, they're just for rich people into it. And it's too complicated. And he was so skeptical. So he learned the lesson the hard way. I was in $3 million from a breach of contract case. And he found out about insurance companies, right? That they only protect against simple negligence. And when things get really expensive, their business model is to deny coverage, right? Which leaves you holding the bag. So the only thing that you can really do as an investor is to be proactive with having good insurance in place, because that's your best, first, cheapest line of defense to a lawsuit happening. I recommend having an umbrella policy, you know, like there's 1 to 3 million, you know, anything in there, they're really cheap to have. So bulk up on some umbrella policy and then use either like an LLC or a series LLC structure. The most effective structure you can do that for cost effectiveness is a series LLC. You can form them either in Delaware, Texas, Nevada, or Wyoming, where they have strong charging order protection. You want to form it in one of those states, and but you can use it in any other state based upon the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution. The same reason why you can form a Delaware LLC in Delaware and use it anywhere else in the United States. Same thing applies to series LLCs formed in Delaware or Texas or Nevada or Wyoming and use there. Ultimately, you want a series LLC because you can form them anonymously, connect it, have it, everything pull back to a law firm. So all the information is connected by attorney-client privilege. So if people look to try to sue you, it doesn't look like you even own anything. And then what you can do is compartmentalize every asset for free. Because when you form a series LLC, what it does is you have a parent entity and it can form an unlimited number of these things called child series underneath it. Act just like normal children. They're free to create, but they work just like individual LLCs. And then it costs you nothing to maintain. You don't have to do anything with them each year. So essentially what you get is you form one company with one EIN number, it's one bank account, one set of accounting books, but you get to create an infinite number of these child series for free. Each one of them compartmentalizes every single one of your assets that you own. So if anything happens to you, it's all held inside of a structure. You don't own anything anymore. It's all held by this asset holding company that's anonymous. The asset holding company owns all of the assets anonymously. All the assets are compartmentalized. So if there's a lawsuit against any one of the assets, they can't go after any of the other assets and they can't come after you. And that if anybody looks to sue you, it doesn't look like you own anything on paper. And that's how you stop lawsuits before they even start, because people don't sue people who look like on paper that they qualify for food stamps. It's just the nature of the business that comes with it. And if they do decide to sue you, you have like a, this mountain of protection that's like put in place. Mm-hmm. Or like they look about and they're like, oh my God, this is terrible to fight through. Like so far, we've lost zero cases into it. I mean, every single lawsuit, we handle about a lawsuit a month that comes through. And every single one of those cases is either just dropped outright because of the nature of the defense that are put in place, or we settle them for almost nothing as they come through. So it's incredibly effective. And it's what all of the wealthy people that I know that are worth, you know, let's say wealthy is 5 million plus. I know that's not like a ton of money, right? But most people are trying to get to that $5 million benchmark in net worth. Every single one of them uses an advanced structure that's sophisticated. That's like a savvy, detail-oriented, serious person. You find a lot of people that have a ton of money that aren't that way. But all of the ones that are savvy, detail-oriented, and had to work their way to building their wealth, like all of those people are using these types of structures.
So the Series LLC in Delaware, do you run into issues when you have a multi-state portfolio where you're having to do these like registrations of foreign corporations and things of that nature and file like multiple layers of tax returns? Have it in Delaware, your properties are in Illinois because you live in Chicago. Does it create layers of additional paperwork in that way?
Yeah, so what we do is typically we'll use Texas or Wyoming. I actually like to use Texas because Texas doesn't have any yearly fees and it's just as strong as protection as everywhere else. And it's great on that side of it. Cost. It's not a huge cost, but you know, it's something, right? I don't like
to add up, especially you had a bunch of them, right?
Yeah. The deal is that we're actually never holding any assets directly in the name of any of these child series. So let's say that I have like this parent that I created, right? It's at the top. A parent now has child series A that gets spun up and that child series A is actually going to own land trust A. Land trust A is going to own property A that's located in Illinois. So now I have like a Texas entity, right, that has a child series and has a land trust, but then that land trust is what's on title to the property that's in Illinois. So now if anybody looks at like the land trust, they're going to say, well, we can't find out who actually is associated with this land trust because everything ties back to this law firm. So it's all protected by attorney-client privilege that comes into it. Yeah. And then if the client needs to get financing or something like that, they just produce the trust, which shows that they're actually the ultimate owner in person and controlling the trust, that the law firm doesn't actually control the trust. They can make the private disclosure. We don't blow any anonymity there. And we don't have to pay any annual fees to Illinois or any other state where we're owning assets because the trust is the one that's actually on title to the asset, not the LLC. So there's no foreign entity registration requirements that happen. So we can own as many assets as we want to, wherever we want to in the states. We don't have any double taxation issues. We don't have any state, you know, foreign filing issues that are outside of the things that you're already having to deal with right now. There's no additional complications or tax returns that run into your life. Everything is structured as a disregarded entity with the minimal amount, a very minimal amount of maintenance costs and without any additional pieces other than, you know, what otherwise you have to pay, right? So a lot of people like own assets in their personal name and they're saying they think that they're like saving every dollar, owning assets in their personal name, because of some of these issues. And that's where, you know, those are the number one customers that we have, or clients, you know, that we have come in, is that they were like, hey, listen, this is actually not going to cost you any more additional time for you to do, because they're all disregarded entities. You're still keeping a set of books for everything, aren't you? Okay, great. So you're still just going to have to do that. Tag the income and expenses for each property. Everything else, there's no renewals that you have to do outside of like a single LLC every year, right? So you end up with these, you know, your run cost for this stuff is like $500 or like $1,000 a year, depending on how many entities that you need for, and that really boils down to tax issues. And then you have like setups, right? That would come into like do the setup costs on, which is variable depending on how many assets you have and like what type, right? So all of this stuff is super affordable and easy to manage. I mean, that's why I've spent 8 years just focusing on like what's the most effective systems that have the minimal amount of costs and the easiest runtime. Because ultimately, I think that's what we all want as investors, right? We really want our time back, right? And that's what we're able to deliver for people. It's the best solutions that give you your time back.
So the child LLC is the beneficiary of that land trust?
Yeah. So you have the land trust. The child series is the beneficiary of the child series A is the beneficiary of the land trust. The client is actually something called like the substitute trustee of the land trust. So like the law firm will actually be what's called the nominee trustee. So the one that's listed on title, but we immediately resign as trustee the moment that the assets transferred in. Happens automatically. So the client's always in control of the property. Money flows from that trust to the child series to the parent, and then from the parent as an owner's distribution back to the client, right?
But so is that three bank accounts that you just described?
You don't have to do like multiple bank accounts. You can, a lot of times what people, all of our clients are doing is to say, great, I have my asset holding company, which is my series LLC. I'm going to set up a completely separate company. We call that an operating company that owns no assets. It's the one that signs all of the leases. That way you're not personally liable for a breach of the lease or any other thing else that can damage your credit score, because we want to protect you personally to protect your credit score. And then we run all of the transactions through that operating company. Yeah. So like everybody pays the operating company. The operating company acts like it's a property manager. So like client will still, if they're doing self-management, they're like, cool, I work for this other company that they're the ones that are the leasing entity. I work for them. So it makes it where you're not the owner, which is kind of nice, like in terms of like the relationship and expectations that happen in lease situations. And then the money is now, it's like, cool, the money is held by his operating company. Now the operating company distributes cash that it has on like a monthly or quarterly basis, whatever you feel most appropriate. I'd recommend to do it at least quarterly and distribute it to the asset holding company. So it's one bank account for the operating company, one bank account for this parent series LLC. The parent series LLC is the one that you're actually having all of your books in, of what is the income and expenses for each one of those properties. Yeah. So the books, you can have one bank account. As long as you have books that say, here's the income and expenses for each of the individual properties, because that's what courts actually look at to say, like, are you treating these as separate businesses? As they want to see income and expenses profiled, right? So that means you don't have to have all these different bank accounts, which makes your life way, way easier. And you're doing the same amount of bookkeeping that you would be doing anyway to know what's the true ROI for each one of these properties that I have, and including like cost basis and stuff like that for your tax purposes and whatnot, right? And then that's it. That's all you got to do. As I got two structures. I got one structure that I do all my day-to-day transactions in. I have an asset holding company that holds all of my assets. Otherwise, I don't really touch anything with it at all. If I get a new asset, probably going to acquire that in my personal name if I'm doing conventional financing and then transferring it into the asset afterwards through the land trust. And I can do that all without avoiding like the due on sale clause and any other issues there. Otherwise, I just contact Royal Legal Solutions every time I acquire a new asset to be able to create the child series in the trust. We move that in and now it runs in the background. It's all maintained for me. I just manage my cash flow coming in from all of my leases that come in every month from all of my tenants. I move it out every quarter into my asset holding company. I update my books and that's all I got to do. And then we do twice yearly meetings with the clients to ensure they're running everything correctly, because obviously there's moving parts here, right? So we check in twice a year, make sure everything's done. Did you acquire any assets? Forget to move them in. Kind of watch everybody's back on that. And then we provide next day support from the paralegal team via email and escalated to attorneys meetings if there's ever questions on it. That's the kind of the full gamut of how that works.
Does the operating company also file its own set of taxes?
No, because it's going to have zero income, right? So like it would be a $0 tax return. Right?
Yeah, but you would do that. You would still do that, right? I mean, wouldn't that be part of the legal veil if that wasn't a tax filing? Does that then open you up to have that veil, the corporate veil pierced if someone were a really, really strong attorney?
So corporate veil like being pierced means that like they get to treat you and the entity as like the same entity.
It's a problem though. If they sue that operating company and they pierce that corporate veil, you are personally liable now, yeah. And they can go backdoor every other one of the assets that you set up.
So the issue is really turns on the question is that company having a tax return indicative of the fact of a corporate veil being able to be pierced?
If it doesn't have a tax return.
Right. If it doesn't, right? And I say, like, is it dispositive?
Yeah.
From my understanding of it is that tax returns aren't dispositive. What is dispositive is business records that come into it. So like filing, having a $0 tax return filed for an entity is not dispositive upon the fact of, are these two entities really truly the same entity? There's really only a couple of ways that you can pierce a corporate veil, right? The most common one that we're worried about here is typically called like an alter ego theory, saying that these two companies are really the same company. What happens in alter ego theories for most cases, right? It's that people will file an LLC, for example, they start to run their business out of the LLC. The LLC doesn't have any books. And that when Daniel wants, and Daniel just goes to that LLC bank account and then just starts taking money out of it. Well, let's say, well, you're not really running that like a business, right? You don't have books that are associated with it. You're really just pulling money out of it and treating it like as if it's your own bank account. You're not documenting money that you're pulling out as like an owner's distribution. And that at the end of the day, there's usually there's a 7-factor test that most states employ for alter ego theories for piercing the veil. None of those are a tax return to my knowledge. And everything that's dispositive really comes down to the bookkeeping. That like courts are really looking at saying, like, do you have bookkeeping that says you're keeping track of business income and expenses for each LLC as they apply to each property here? So I would say at maximum, what I would say is if you're wanting to be on the extreme side of caution, I would be look at having a separate set of books for the operating company that says any money that flowed through it also got distributed out to the asset holding company. But it wouldn't be necessary to file a $0 tax return for those LLCs. However, I've also run into CPAs that are saying like, well, every LLC that you have, you should always have a tax return filed for every single one of them.
So they may want that.
They may want that. And this is where we get into a different question, right? Which is, what is in the bounds of like the strict, the most strict sense of the rules, right? Versus like, what's the practicality of where's the real risk, right? So there's always a question that I always ask professionals when I work with them, especially like CPAs, is that I always like, are you, I know there's three hats. There's the white hat, there's the gray hat, and then there's the black hat. I never work with black hats because black hats are going to end me, like get me in jail, right? They're going to be recommending that I do stuff, hoping that we're not going to get caught. Mm. And I'm like, nah, that's too much exposure. I know if I work with people that are totally white hat and everything they do is that it's like over compliant, right? It's over compliant that we're paying money and doing things to not actually reduce the amount of risk. Because I look at everything, I'm a litigator, right? I look at everything in terms of like, what is the risk that I'm being exposed to for doing something or not doing something? And it's all like risk reward games that are going on. And so what I'm really looking for is like, what's this sweet spot of saying like, where do we actually need to, where's the sweet spot of the most cost-effective version? So like, there's a thing that we all do, right? Or most of all of us do, where it's like, hey, we have a company car and we write off so much of the expenses of the company car. Well, IRS says, well, we should log every single time with the exact mileage that we go into this car to be able to write it off. You talk to your CPA, they're really like, nah, you just take like an estimate, run it. And if it gets called out, like we'll deal with it at that time. And they'll use some type of like estimated mileage and it'll be fine. But no, it's not what your white hat CPA is going to tell you. Right? So I have CPAs like, hey, you really need to like have a pencil and write down the exact mileage every time. And so you're doing a lot more work to be able to cover off on something that's actually not as big of, it's like the risk reward isn't there to go do it like the technical right, you know, way. But I would defer to everybody's CPA and your own judgment into it, right? Like, I'm not here to like be like, hey, you should do everything the way that necessarily I say to do it. And actually, if you feel like that you want to do it that way, because it makes you feel good to do it that way and it feels right, then do it. At the end of the day, all of this stuff is only as good as your peace of mind. So if you feel like you need to do that to give you the peace of mind you need, now hell with it. Because all of this stuff is just to give you peace of mind, you know? So do it whatever way you like you feel like on that, right? I can only tell you like my experience.
So does your yearly meeting with your client create some kind of like annual report or like meeting of the shareholders that then creates that document trail to also kind of protect if there were a lawsuit?
Yeah. So you'll have yearly meetings that get put into it, right? And most of the time they're actually just formulaic waivers of minutes. It's just to create documentation that says we're looking at something at least like once a year. And what you're doing and all of these things, right, is you're just doing like formal compliance to build a paper trail, right? Mm-hmm. That comes with it. So,
I mean, usually what happens from what I understand is like the lawsuit comes and then the secretary of the company, along with the owner of the company, stays up all night creating the last 9 years worth of paper trail records the day before that stuff is due to the other side of the lawsuit. That's like kind of the horror story that I've heard. So you guys are trying to do something in advance of all that and properly create that paper trail. Is that part of the
right? Yeah, that's part of everything we're doing, right? So like what we're trying to get to, or where we're at actually is what I should say, is that our belief is, if we set everything up for you from your asset protection, your estate planning, your tax strategy, that you can manage everything that you need to do in your life gets managed in 2 yearly meetings, unless you decide to call extra meetings with it, right? And that all of the things that need to happen run by a standardized system and process that like our team maintains. The idea is for you to not have to think about any of those things. And I say, well, here's actually the efficient compliance that we can get to by saying we work with real estate investors as like a segment and we work inside of these kinds of systems, which allows us to have huge leverage and saying that what we're going to do is actually super repeatable. That is the way that professionals can say, yeah, I have this thing that's called repeatable or cookie cutter, but it also happens to be the very best thing you can get because it's only for a particular segment of customers. Right? We're not doing it like for everybody else. We're only for real estate investors and primarily for single family home real estate investors.
So what are some advice or other structures or setups? Like, what's the answer to the tax problem? Maybe we touched on it already. Maybe you have a better solution, but how can an investor reduce their taxable liability at the end of the year?
Yeah. So of course, I'm sure you guys have already heard about, okay, cool. You can have your home office deductions, your auto deductions, you know, shelter money through your kids by paying them like a reasonable wage every year. If you're self-employed, right, there's the S corporation to be able to save you on self-employment taxes, but that's all like the really low hanging fruit that everybody's already heard of. The really sexy thing that we do is the private foundation. The private foundation is a game changer. When I talk to people and they're making, first of all, anybody that we've talked to that's making over 150K a year, we are able to save them enough money in taxes to actually pay for everything that we do, including all the asset protection, the estate planning, and even the tax strategy itself, because we're so good at how do we find tax savings. Private foundation is a critical part of that because private foundations allow you to do like wild stuff. You can take up to 30% of your income, push it into a private foundation that you set up. That private foundation then can then go make whatever investments it wants to make from the stock market to real estate or whatever, to be able to increase the capital of the private foundation. And so like, imagine that as like way better than a solo 401k or something like that, that where it's locked up inside of a retirement account, because in a private foundation, you're actually able to be a director, which means you can pull a director's wage, which is an undefined amount of money, some type of reasonable wage for the services that you're doing. So what you're actually able to do is to create a retirement account that's 30% of whatever your income is from all sources that can grow tax-free over time. And then whenever you want cash out of it, these are your director's wages they're able to pull from. So it's much more effective than your retirement account.
What are some of the downsides? I mean, does a foundation have to give away a certain amount each year?
5%.
5%.
5%. You give away 5% to your church or to whatever else you want to do. We have a program where I have a nonprofit that supports child literacy. That's actually from and dyslexia remediation. And we have our internal CPAs donate time to say, like, listen, if you're donating your 5% every year to Scott's nonprofit, essentially, that they donate their time to do the tax returns for you for your nonprofit. Right? So it's like a way in which we're able to make it where it's like a win, like all around. And so for some people that don't have a designated charity, they really like to take advantage of something like that.
That's pretty cool. So is that 5% yearly of the total assets that are on hand?
That's right. 5% of the total amount of all the assets that are held by the nonprofit.
Yeah. Okay. So if there happens to be $1 million in there, and that was your 30%, you're going to have to give away 50 grand of that million.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the following year, you have to give away another 50 grand.
Yeah, you got
to
give another, but yeah, so it'll be like a million. So you'll have that money invested. If you're smart, you probably made at least 20% on that money. So now you have like a million too. And now you're going to say, well, cool, of that million too, I got to give away 5% of my million too. So that's going to be 60K. So you're actually going to be giving away more money every year. But the juice of it let's say that your 30% was a million. Most people's tax brackets, if these are like doctors or investors or whatnot, right? Most people's tax brackets, even though they're trying as hard as they can, it's usually around 20%. Like even they're not paying like even the top. They've done everything that their normal, typical CPAs are able to do them as best that they know how. And they got down to 20. So instead of paying, you could either say, hey, I'm happy to pay the tax on it. So now I have 800K, or I can have $1 million inside of my private foundation because I didn't have to pay tax on it. And so when then I reinvest my money and turn 20% on it, I can either have like a million two minus the 100K that I had to pay out for the 5%. So I'm at $1 million, or I can be at 800,000 and then 20% of that. So I'm at 9.6, but actually I'm not at 9.6 because I had to pay tax on the cap gains that of that 160K that I made, right? So I'm really at like 9.2. So you can see like the numbers actually are really easy to say, like, would you really want to have like 9.2 or 1.1 in year two? So it's a no-brainer in the sense of why you would want to avoid taxes on the front end and avoid taxes on your cap gains that you're making by having everything structured in the private foundation. And then whenever you take the money out into your personal name, you'll pay tax on it at that point, unless you're strategic, right? And if you're strategic, what you're doing is you're buying syndication deals that have like 180% bonus depreciation associated with them, and you have real estate professional designations, or you're buying, you know, carbon emission capture systems, or fractional interest inside of like gas stations that can apply to any sources of income because they're actually machinery depreciation. And then your investments actually give you tax write-offs that you structure whenever you're going to have taxable events. And that's why good strategic planning is always pays for itself, right? I mean, that's why we can come in and be like, yeah, we're expensive for like what it is that we do, right? I mean, we're the bottom end of the top tier providers, but I've never seen it where we've crunched numbers for people and say like, we didn't give you like at least like a 200-300% return on your money and what you paid to us with inside of 2 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you could literally like put the million in, give away 50 grand, and then take back a $950,000 payment for being the director the following year, and then you have to pay taxes on that.
So like if you do it like that aggressively, right, we're going to want to look into it about like how are we going to justify like a reasonable salary out to it of like pulling that much money out. For everybody that we work with, typically what's actually happening is that they're taking the money that they need to take to be able to live their life, right? And then but they're like, what's all this extra income that I have? All this extra income I have, I'm really going to use it to invest to be able to increase my net worth. Great. Now my private foundation is the right vehicle to do it. So that's really how most people are using it is going to be like in that kind of circumstance. And they're like, great, I'm going to continue to increase my net worth really strategically through my private foundation until I reach this time period in my life where I'm like, great, I'm ready to shift focus from money making onto something else that I have going on in my life, and I've accumulated enough assets. And at that point, then I'm just going to start pulling a wage, and I want to make $250,000 a year because that's what my lifestyle costs me. And I say, great. Well, you've built enough assets and we have it structured in this way where you are now able to do that. That's the nuts and bolts of like that kind of lifestyle, that kind of like thinking about where money gets you.
Okay, cool. Are there any book recommendations that, you know, maybe around this topic, maybe just like life-changing books that you would make mention of, Scott?
Yeah. So actually all of these things I have books on and I have video trainings on, and they're actually all inside of what we call the vault, which I think is like a link that my promotion team gave to you. So from royallegalsolutions.com, we have a video on the homepage, which is how does like the team work, meeting the team and getting to see like what's all the process and the typical recommendations that we make for everybody. Inside of the vault though, is where I've taken all the education materials that I've produced over the last 8 years. So I have like 8 eBooks in there. I have tons of videos, white papers. It's all categorized like by different products, different types of strategies, and all of the training. We have free weekly training that we do. All of those videos are saved in there as well too. And that's from like our CPAs and our attorneys training on like all of these things. And they're much better at explaining than I am. And like they're much more detailed. The reason we created that vault is because we believe in giving away all the information for free, right? And so it's like, if you just go in there and start studying, if you interact with us and tell us like, this is what I'm looking at, we can be like, you should watch these particular things. So like, you know, there's a lot of value in actually just starting to form the relationship and getting educated. But yeah, that's really what I've done. Instead of like trying to write books and sell them, is just, here's all the videos, here's all the stuff my team has produced. It's all for free here in this type of organized place.
Nice. And that URL is, once again,
if you go to royallegalsolutions.com and just connect us through there, we'll be able to get you hooked up into the vault.
Cool. So I have 2 closing questions here. The first, the crown jewel of wisdom, Scott, if you could go back to the time when you were maybe looking at that deal for the commercial property way back when, knowing everything you know now, what would be the crown jewel of wisdom that you would go back and share with yourself then?
Yeah, I think like through that property and then through like my entrepreneurial life, what I would have told myself is actually just to like relax. Like I thought that I had to do like every possible thing to be successful. Like every, and so I was so hyperactive and stressed out all the time. And so I was like, I didn't need to do that. I didn't have to be like that. You know, so I wish I would have just relaxed more and everything would have taken care of what it needed to get taken care of.
And my final question, what is the kindest thing anyone has ever done for you, Scott?
Oh man, my godfather. He was the one that like talked to me about going to law school. I was actually a cage fighter before I went to law school.
Oh wow.
I was doing professional tutoring in the evenings of like Spanish and calculus and chemistry and physics to like high school students that were going to the private schools because I could make $100 an hour teaching those kids. And so I only had to work like 10 hours a week to pay for all my expenses. And then all the rest of the time I was training professionally in martial arts, wrestling and kickboxing and competing and UFC kinds of like events. And it was actually a ridiculous amount of fun. I'm a lifetime athlete and I love physical sports that are like that. But he was like, go to law school. And eventually like I got out of my system, right? And I was a young man. This is what young men do, right? I got out of my system and then I went to law school, and, you know, of course, then that propelled me into business and, you know, ways that I could actually leverage in helping more people than, you know, just getting kicked in the head.
Yeah, true enough. Who knows where that path would have led, right?
That wouldn't have been here.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Good stuff. Hey, I had a blast. We could probably keep going for another hour or two, but I'm going to be respectful of everyone's time here. Thanks for coming on the show, Scott. I had a blast. Couple pages of notes. A lot of great information here, so I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.